recently took a trip to California that was as much of a pilgrimage as anything else. I'd like to read you just some notes that I made along the way. This is dated April 19th, 1997. That's all right, I have plenty of light here. We, Larry, Kate, and I are flying home now from our trip to California. This trip has been, among other things, a pilgrimage. From this standpoint, the journey has been a wonderful success. Marge Ranney escorted our activities and acted as our host to Los Angeles, City of the Angels, of which she must certainly be counted as one. Her escort was doubly meaningful as she hosted and escorted Mother 30 years before to India and elsewhere. From the start, visiting Yoganandaji's lake shrine, we experienced the beauty and peace of that oasis of spiritual vibrations amidst the desert of worldly concerns and activity. With a beautifully constructed temple, newly built above the lake, every plant and building are kept immaculate. Truly, the outer shell of this hive of God stands as a testament to orderliness, and the feeling of peace remains as a testament to the lasting presence of a great saint. The service we attended on Sunday was appropriately focused on finding peace. As the speaker, Swami Mityananda, commented, "When out on the ocean in an 18-foot boat with no land in sight, there is no need for any to speak of God. The open grandeur of the sky and vastness of ocean, the vulnerability of man, makes for a wordless worship." Breathtaking imagery. Next visit was to Mount Washington, headquarters of Self-Realization Fellowship. The spiritual vibrations of Master and over 50 years of sincere seekers are terrific. Meditating in the main building, Lari Mahasya emerged to my inner vision, only to dissolve into Sri Yukteswar. Master then came to view. Feeling the blessings of those great masters, I felt closer to the one infinite master through and through. Next on our pilgrimage was the mission of San Juan Capistrano, founded on November 1, 1776. This mission must have been a true oasis to early spiritual travelers. Trees and plants imported from Asia and Africa, rustic tools for tanning hides and pressing olives into oil. The setting is charming and peaceful. The highlight is a tiny chapel with a statue of Saint Peregrine. Dedicated especially to those who suffer from cancer, this site has been the place of many healings. Certainly those facing death straight on are surely motivated to seek the divine presence. That little chapel is vibrant with God's presence to such a degree that I felt transported to realms spiritual. The blue of the Christ magnified before me. O Heavenly Father, east and west joined, north and south come together in an apex of single-pointed spiritual consciousness that is at once localized and circumference never. Certainly we have proof positive that Catholic, Protestant, Jew, Buddhist, and Hindu all derive their inspiration from a single source. Surely the world at large will one day come to this unifying vision and create peace among all people of this earth. Motoring down Southern California coastline, we arrived at Encinitas, home of the hermitage that Master had visions of since a young man. A gift of Rajashri Janakananda, upon Master's return from India, the Encinitas Hermitage sits atop a bluff that overlooks the Pacific Ocean. Pacific, which means peace, is certainly an apt description for this beautiful setting. Terraced ponds and waterfalls display flowers and trees that are only outdone by an oceanic vista. Again, what peace, what joy to tread the same ground walked upon by that great master from India. A bhajan was given that evening that featured East Indian instruments and chanting. What wonderful service by devotees of God. Next day, on to Prem, grandson of Papa Ramdas. What joy, what sheer bliss it is to be in his presence. His joyous wife, Sheila, served us delicious lassi, a yogurt drink flavored with rose water. Not an hour passed that we were not served another course of food. The feeling in their home resonated with the all-powerful vibration of Ram Nam. Drunk on the name of God, the mind is suspended, Only the feeling of God remains. That night, Abhajan of Prem, Sheila, and their son Deepak, leading over 100 voices in music devoted to God. Special mention should be made of Shivak Ram, Louise Annette, and Sharon Janice. Shivak Ram has published Swami Ramdas's books here in America and started a newsletter to spread interest in Papa's and Anandashram's work. Louise is a very devoted soul who has helped to organize the newsletter. Sharon has pursued the spiritual path and has written an autobiographical book due to be published this fall. All made harmonious spiritual company during our stay at Prem's. What joy it is to live in service to one all-powerful spirit that resides within us all. There can be no doubt as to the value of being in the presence of true devotees of God. Prem and Sheila radiate the presence of God, service towards all, and humility. When we stand in the presence of such ones, God is magnified within us. Such was my experience. God can be said to be ever new joy. Certainly in traveling to these holy places and meeting devotees of the all-powerful Ram, bliss and joy was experienced and continues to ring in my soul. Marge then escorted us to a Zen monastery on Mount Baldy. Marge sees it as her path to serve God by serving those who come across her path by housing, feeding, and making travel arrangements for them. She did this with us in such perfection that we felt as though the guests were treated as God. She had also done this for Mother many years before. Whenever I think of her now, I feel her firmly ensconced in my heart. High atop Mount Baldy, above the bustle of busy Los Angeles, is perched a monastery made up of scattered cabins that houses 12 full-time inmates. The pine trees whisper in the breeze, carrying a peaceful vibration and a wonderful fragrance of dry air and pines. We sat around a fire pit and felt the vibrations of the many meditative minds that have been there. In Zen practice, the goal is the empty mind. Through that empty mind, room is made for the infinite mind. The renunciant we met there had clear eyes and a calm manner. Coming from Germany, he showed that true seekers are worldwide. His calm intelligence spoke volumes for their practice. From the high mountain, we drove to the ocean to bathe our feet and be purified in the ocean. Singing God's name to the ocean, it seemed the ocean sang its own song of praise back. Blissful harmony as I breathed the universe and it breathed me. Final moments spent with Marge, her housemate Jim, who plays a beautiful Indian wooden flute and stands as protector of Marge. Also Dawn, my daughter, who found new friends in Marge and Jim. My heart sings in gratitude to my infinite beloved for the blessings he continues to pour out. So much thanksgiving for the joy of visiting the various sacred centers and personalities and for the ideal companionship of fellow pilgrims Larry and Kate. O infinite divine, make your presence known to one and all. Make this universe dance in harmony with your song through and through. As I finish this, I hear in my soul Prem singing Hari Om, Hari Om, Hari Om. So I thought you might like to hear a bit of the pilgrimage that we took there. I'd like to read a beautiful writing entitled Light Out of Africa. This is written by Nelson Mandela, President of the Republic of South Africa. Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, and fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small doesn't serve the world. There's nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We were born to manifest the glory of God within us. It's not just in some of us, it's in everyone. And as we let our light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others. Isn't that beautiful? Yes. I'd like to read this evening from the Gospel of Swami Ramdas. There are copies of these on the back table. And actually, the made-up copies of the talk by Nelson Mandela, the writing there, and you may take them if you wish. These books are also back there, and you may take them. There's a suggested donation, but they are actually free for your taking. This is a recorded conversation, recorded by Swami Satchidananda, of my spiritual teacher, Mother Hamilton, and her husband, Ralph Hamilton, in 1957, when they were at the ashram in the south of India, called Anandashram. They went there to see Papa Ramdas, who is a great saint there in the south of India, and put Mother through the experiences of the mystical crucifixion so that she might realize the fullness of her own God realization. This is Ralph Hamilton questioning Papa. To see God within, what should be done? Papa, one should pray to God within to reveal himself. One should meditate on him. First of all, one has to know and believe that God is within. Then only can one direct all one's prayers to him within. The mind must be attuned to him constantly. Then alone can he be realized in one's heart. Ralph Hamilton, but meditation is difficult. Papa, constant practice is necessary. In the Bhagavad Gita, the same has been discussed. Arjuna, after hearing something about divine knowledge from the lips of Lord Krishna, asks the Lord how he can control the mind, which is restless as the wind and hard to still. The Lord answers that it is, no doubt, difficult to control the mind, but it is possible to do so with abhyasa and varyagya. Abhyasa means practice, and varyagya means dispassion. You should have regular practice of spiritual disciplines, and you must have absolute dispassion for worldly things. You must be completely detached from them. Dispassion comes by discrimination. You must know that all these things in the world are perishable, and by attaching ourselves to them, thinking that we will be happy, we get nothing but sorrow and misery. The happiness that you get in the world is momentary and is always followed by unhappiness. So we must not run after these illusory things. Real happiness comes only from God. We must get detached from worldly things and attach ourselves to God, who is absolute bliss and peace. When our mind is attached to God, it will think of him constantly. Then meditation becomes easy. Steady and constant practice, too, is required to attain quicker results. Ralph Hamilton. They may have to take several incarnations, too, to attain to that standard of meditation. Papa. No, no. Pray to God earnestly, and he will come to your rescue. Of course, when you pray, you must have that much faith. By his grace, everything is possible. If a man tries to succeed by his own effort, he fails. If he fails, so much the better for him, because he learns that he is weak and helpless. In that helplessness, God's grace will flow into him. When we think we are capable of doing something, he will leave it to us to do it. In this connection, Ramdas remembers a story. A devotee of Shiva was passing through a forest. He had in his possession a few valuable articles. Seeing him, a robber wanted to waylay him. When the robber approached him, and he knew that he would be robbed of his belongings, he shouted aloud the name of Shiva and cried for help. Shiva was then seated with his consort Parvati in Kailas. Shiva suddenly left Parvati and came away without telling her. But a few seconds, Shiva went back. To Parvati's question, Shiva explained, "A devotee was in danger and called for my help. As I was going to him, I saw him taking a stone in his hand when I was about to fling it at the robber. When the devotee thought he could take care of himself, I had nothing to do, so I came away." You see how God is ready to come to our help when we call on him in a state of helplessness. But if we have a trace of feeling that we can help ourselves, he will not come to our aid. Papa continued, "When we are talking about Shiva and Parvati, Ramdas will tell you something else. Shiva used to go away from Kailas, leaving Parvati alone. He never felt sorry for having to go alone, as he had realized his oneness with all beings and knew that there is no real separation from Parvati. But Parvati did not have this experience. She felt lonely when Shiva was away from her. One day she requested Shiva to come to give her the same experience as he had, so that she would not feel his absence. Shiva agreed and asked her to sit for meditation in a particular posture and close her eyes. When she did so, he asked, 'What do you see in your mental vision?' 'Parvati, I see your form because you are my most beloved.' 'Shiva, seeing my form is no good. You must take your mind deeper. What do you see now?' 'I hear the sound Om.' 'That won't do. When you hear the sound, the hearer and the heard are separate. They must merge into one. Go deeper still. What do you see now?' 'Parvati, I see flashes of light.' 'Shiva, when you see light, the seer and the seen are separate. They must merge into one. Go deeper still. What do you see now?' There was no answer. Shiva asked again, 'What do you see now? What do you see now?' There was no answer. She had merged into the infinite existence of God, the universal self. She no longer remained as a separate entity to say what she saw or heard. After some time, when she had returned to world consciousness, the words of Aham Brahmasmi issued forth from her. She had experienced her absolute oneness with the infinite existence and could no longer feel the separation from Shiva. What that absolute experience is cannot be described. Those who have experienced it know what it is, but they cannot tell others what it is. It cannot be expressed in words. In this connection, Ramdas will tell you another story. There was a Brahmin who had two boys whom he sent to the hermitage of a sage for 12 years of study. During their stay with their master, the boys learnt everything and returned home. Their father called them, one of them, and asked him to tell him what Brahman is. The boy went on quoting from the scriptures all that he could remember to tell his father about Brahman. The father then called the other boy and asked him the same question repeatedly. The boy kept silent. There was no answer at all. The father then said, "Son, you have found him, but your brother has not. Brahman cannot be expressed in words. Those who have found him do not try to explain about him. They remain in silence. Silence is Brahman. Om is the first sound that rose from the bosom of the infinite existence of God, as though to break the silence that ensued, a devotee asked a question about the scriptures. And Papa answered at length, describing the events as having actually happened historically. Mother Hamilton, "Papa, I would like to verify a revelation which God has given me. You speak of the scriptures as actual history of the places, people, and events described. Is it not true, as God has shown me, that every scripture tells not only about the creation or expression of God in the form of the universe and various stellar systems, but also that they tell the history of the evolution of every man from the human to the divine?" Papa looked straight at Mother Hamilton and said in a very powerful voice, "You have made him say it," confirming what God had revealed to her. She said afterwards that as Papa looked at her and spoke those words so forcefully, it was as though a bolt of lightning had gone right through the center of her head. It was a great moment of truth. I would like to speak this evening on great moments of truth. It is said in the scriptures that truth is God and God is truth. Now we could reasonably ask the question, what is truth? We learn what it is when we are children to tell the truth and not to tell a lie. We also learn that there are greater truths in this world and there are lesser truths in this world. We know of relative truths, and we are told also that there are absolute truths. It can be said that the laws of man are relative truths. Things that are said and done at one point are then changed and transmuted into something else. And so we find some rather funny types of rules and laws in the world that become outdated and show that when they were made, they made total sense to the people at that point. But perhaps today we would find silly. There are some fun examples. For instance, in Massachusetts, there's a law that makes it illegal for someone to get on a trolley car within 4 hours after they'd eaten garlic. In Seattle, there is a law in the books that made it illegal to carry a goldfish on the bus that was not lying still. You know, these things probably made sense to somebody at some point, and you could see where perhaps somebody got splashed by a goldfish or was annoyed by it, and so they went out and passed a law about it. We are told that God gave Moses 10 commandments that he brought down from the mountain with him, and that these were to be followed out by humankind. Now, when we go into the interior meaning of this story, going up into the mountain means going up into the mountain of your own being. Now, things are talked about symbolically that happen internally. Why is upwardness mentioned in the Bible as a going up in a mountain? That represents your own spinal system and your own brain. Within the spinal system and the nervous system are conduits for higher consciousness. We are told in yogic philosophy that the life force comes in through the medulla, which is at the base of the skull, just behind at the top where the neck joins with the head. And this is the mouth of God that's spoken about in the Bible. And so the mouth of God is the place where the word is spoken. Now the word is the vibration or your life force that comes into the body, to the nervous system, is collected in the brain and is distributed down through all the nervous system. Now, this is at variance with what we hear about in biology and how the body works. We are told about chemical processes where the food is brought in to the stomach, assimilated out through the blood system, and feeds and nourishes along with oxygen that we breathe in, everything that we need for this body. But what is it that happens at the moment of birth or at the moment of death that's unique? You could take bread or any other kind of food, stuff it into a dead person's mouth, and they will not live. It will not force them to live. There is no life force left within that individual that will animate that body any longer. Anytime that I have seen a person whose life force have left them and they are pronounced to be dead, it is a very peculiar feeling, and perhaps all of you have had it also. It is not as if the person has just stopped breathing or that they are somehow in suspended state. It is as if there is a presence that is missing. And that presence is very noticeable. That is the life force, the spirit, the soul of that individual that has vacated that body. I had an experience once when my grandmother passed away. And I had been meditating for quite some time and following the spiritual path. And so I went there and I felt sad that she had passed away, but she had gone through several years of illnesses and strokes and that kind of thing. And so in a way, it was a release from this body that she was having a difficult time with. Well, I had other relatives who were there and they were crying and lots of tears were coming forward. And this minister had not known my grandmother, since my grandmother had not known the inside of a church for probably well over 50 or 60 years. So he went on to say that he was an economics professor and started to talk about the economics of that agricultural area that where I grew up and she had lived. And I thought, my God, this minister could turn grief into boredom faster than anybody else I know, because he was not only an economics professor, but he's a boring one at that. And so I was going inside and thinking to myself that, and I felt the presence of the consciousness of my grandmother. And she saw the great humor in that too. And so, hiding the laughter, but feeling it inside, I felt the great joy of her spirit, having been released from a body that had outgrown its usefulness to her. But her consciousness, who she was, her memories of things, her memory of me, everything remained intact as before. It's an interesting thing when the soul begins to think that it's time to vacate this body. Now this life force, this soul, comes in and inhabits this body, and it does so for a purpose and for a reason. That reason can be because it wants to have experience of this earthly plane and all the things that it brings. Its own uniqueness, its own colors and smells and varieties. But eventually the soul gets connected through desire to this earthly plane. And that creates what is called karma. Now karma means to do or to act. And it is the lawful action that creates its own opposite. So that when we do an action, its opposite comes back to us and it creates a reaction. Newton came up with his great laws of physics. And one of them was, for every action, there is an opposite and equal reaction. This perfectly describes the law of karma. Now, this is not always evident to us because it sometimes has a boomerang effect. When you throw a boomerang out, it can travel quite a distance before it finally turns the corner and comes back to us. And if we're not careful, when it comes back, it can conk us in the head and hurt us. The same is true with karma. When we send actions out from ourselves, we get the opposite reaction coming right back to us. And if we're not careful, it can really knock us for a loop. This sets up a set of circumstances in which we act in the world expecting certain results. Now, it's said that in behavioral sciences, that the worst kind of reinforcement we can get is called intermittent reinforcement. That means that not every time we do something do we get the thing that we're looking for, but it comes intermittently. It comes here and there. So we may go to Las Vegas and play the slot machines there. And we may spend $1 and we may get a whole bucket of dollars back to us. But it doesn't happen every time we put in a dollar. So it happens perhaps one every 100 times, or one every 1,000 times, or one every 10,000 times. But if it comes often enough, it sets up a cause and effect and can be addictive to certain individuals, so that they will spend all of their money and everything that they have looking for that one hit that will give them that satisfaction. So this law of cause and effect works, and it creates attachment. So the other reason, other than exploring this wonderful, vast universe that God has created, is that we have set up this law of karma in our own lives, of cause and effect. And we come back, not because we are creatures of free will anymore necessarily, but because we are destinies, or our destinies rather, have been created by our desire nature. And so we are drawn back by our desires, our desire to experience certain things. Perhaps it is our desire to go to Las Vegas and win that big jackpot that we never got in previous lifetimes. And so back and back we come, always looking for that particular experience that we will think will bring us real happiness. The thing is, though, that as the experiences and these desires and our attachments build within us, we create for ourselves a smaller and smaller universe to live in. Now, if you have ever been subject to an obsession to have a certain thing, you can see that it creates a very myopic view of this universe. Sri Yukteswar told the story to Yoganandaji of the time when he desired the ugliest mutt in the neighborhood. But as a young boy, he just desired this thing above everything else, and he made his life, parents' life, a living hell until he got it. And so this is the way that we are. When we get an obsession focused in our mind, we don't look at the true merits of the object of our desire. Rather, it is the obsession itself, it's the desire itself that takes us over, and not so much the object of desire. There are times that that object of desire can be replaced for another. Sometimes we call this falling in love. We can fall in love with an individual, and we think this is the one and only person for me in my whole life. And we want and we desire that person, and perhaps we acquire them as an object, or perhaps we are left with the longing. But enough time passes by, and then we get another hit from another individual, and we think, well, this is the one. This is the one I've waited for all my life. And so on and so forth it goes, until we have exhausted all the possibilities, because we have eternity to work out all of our desires that we had ever sought to have. But when our desire nature for this lifetime begins to subside, perhaps our body is ill, perhaps we get discouraged, perhaps we just sense that for whatever purposes we have come into this lifetime, it is time to return back into the astral or the causal or the pure oneness of God realms. Then we decide to leave this body. Again, I had a personal experience with that with my great uncle. I loved him a great deal, and he had a fine sense of humor. But one day, as I was meditating, he came before my inner vision, and he said, "It is time for me to leave this body. I want to go." And so I made arrangements and made the trip to go see him, and he told me essentially the same words, that he was tired of living in this body, and he was ready to let it go. Now, I expected him to be gone in a day or two. It was almost a year before he left that body. But the wonderful thing about that was that he was giving me a message that I could then take. And any time that I visited with him, I felt that awareness that his time was near. And so I could really be with him in the fullness of that moment, not being distracted, not thinking of other things while I was with him, but I could be fully present with him. Now, ideally, we would be with each other always this way, but it's not always the case. We get distracted by things in this world, and we don't live necessarily in the fullness of that mind. I also had the great privilege of my own guru, who had been ill for about 8 years. She had had a heart attack and then strokes and then a couple of what are called TIAs, which are kind of a mini stroke. She had also had shingles that on her face that Swedish hospital said was the worst case of shingles they had ever seen. She was, in this way, working out karma for all of us that were to come and follow after these teachings. And so it was a wonderful thing that she was doing, but it was a great sacrifice. And this woman who I had known for so many years, who was the most dynamic, most powerful, most intelligent, most fully loving individual I'd ever met in my life, was at times reduced to barely a living skeleton. And she did this for everyone who would come after. But as we visited one day, I got it that she would not be with us for another Christmas. Rather, she would be with us for just one more Christmas. Christmas Day was the date of her birth. And so this was in January, and I didn't know when she would pass away exactly, but I knew that had less than another 2 years, something less than that. And so each time that I was with her, it gave me an opportunity to be with her as fully and as presently as I could manage. I valued each and every moment. It was like each moment dripped with that feeling of this will one day not be a hand that I can reach out and touch. This will not one day be the person that I can ask my spiritual questions to. This presence that has been with me for so long in my spiritual journey, that has guided me, that has directed me, that has loved me, that has given me everything of her own self so that I might be able to make my journey to God quicker, will one day not be here. And so it gave me that opportunity to be with her as fully as I could. And when that time came, she had a tenacious desire for life and for living life to the fullest. And never once did I hear her complain of her condition. She would tell of the pain that she would have, particularly with the shingles. It was terrific pain that went right through her head. And it was, her whole body would shake at times. The pain was so great. But she never complained of her lot. She never once broke down into what I probably would have been, which is, someone whimpering for some kind of mercy. But rather, she is always focused on how she could make herself better, how she could make that body perfect. And indeed, in the last year in her life, she recovered much of the use of things that she had lost use of previously. Now, many of us come to the conception that to be fully God-realized is not to have any physical problems. But this is not the truth of it. This is a misconception. There are many people who have absolutely perfect bodies, but no God-realization. There are many who have God-realization, but imperfect bodies. Why is this so? Because this body, then, becomes an instrument which they can help those who follow with them. And they can work out physical karma, even as Jesus did for his disciples. By going through the great pain that he did, he could help quicken their own evolution. It is as if a strong man were to come along and help a weaker one with his great load. The spiritual master who has used their body for the highest purpose possible, which is attaining their God realization, then sees it as something that is disposable, and they can dispose of it as they will. Now, not all masters take on karma of their disciples in this way, but many do. Ramana Maharshi took on great illnesses, and throughout most of his life, he had one sort of pain or another. But they don't complain about it, because they know they are fulfilling the highest destiny of which they are capable. And as Jesus said, no love is greater than this, than a man give his life for fellow man. When you are in a position to give of yourself in this way, you consider it your greatest privilege to be able to serve in whatever way that God gives to you to give. Now, his mother said she was no fool. She didn't ask for pain. She didn't ask for these different circumstances. But she was totally surrendered to God. And whatever God gave to her, she took on. There's an interesting story that this is a true story that happened. But a wonderful devotee was once sleeping in her apartment in Iowa. And there the pilot light went out of her furnace system. And the whole room filled up with the fumes of that oil and that gas. And she was dead asleep, and almost literally dead asleep, because as these fumes filled it up, she was passing out. But something inside woke her up and urged her to get to the door. Well, she would take and crawl a few steps to the door, and then she would pass out. And then she would crawl a few more steps and pass out. And at the same identical time, Mother in Seattle woke up, and she could not breathe, and she was coughing out smoke, and she called up one of the devotees to come and help her because she was not barely able to sustain herself. She herself was practically passing out. When the devotee got there, saw this smoky-like substance being coughed out of her lungs at this time. Finally, Becky, the wonderful disciple, who was able to get to the door, open the door, and crawl so her body was half in the door and half out. And it just so happened that a passerby noticed that she was lying there and got the help and got her to a hospital, and she was okay. But this is the kind of help that can come from this transmission, from this power of the spiritual teacher. But it is all up to God. It is not done by the teacher themselves or the guru. Rather, it is something that God gives to that one. As you ascend on this spiritual path, many powers will come to you. You will feel your intuitive channels begin to open up. You will feel your capacity to make changes happen in your material environment. Things that are sometimes called miracles. But really, these become obstacles in the path of one who truly seeks out their oneness with God. Because vain egotism can come up with this desire for miracles. And it's a very subtle thing. You think, well, I can do something good for the world. I can do something good for this person. I can heal this person. But I tell you, if that person is burning out karma, and that is their method of doing it, and you interfere with that, you can slow them up. What you think of as an act of compassion actually takes that individual out of that experience that they're needing. Now, this is not an easy thing to say, because pain and difficulties and suffering is not anything that anybody likes to see, much less experience themselves. But we have to understand how these laws work, and we must use that with intelligent wisdom. And unless we do, we will interfere with another person's individual karma, and this we will then assume a price for, because we have done that interfering. But so we need to carefully consider this. There can only be one answer. One of my favorite Murphy laws you cannot just do one thing. You cannot just do one thing. Because whatever you do in this world has consequences that reach out further than you can imagine. It is like dropping a rock into a pond and watching the ripples go out until it touches the sides of all that pond. And then perhaps the waves come back and they all collide in the center again. You don't know the consequences of what you do. The only possible solution is to empty out your mind, to empty out your desire nature, and focus your mind on this higher consciousness. Because your superconsciousness is by definition connected with the all, then it can properly instruct you as to what to do, how to act, what to say. And it alone can calculate what the proper thing is for you to do. And so sometimes what might appear to be human compassion can actually work as an obstacle for humanity's growth. Sometimes people can take dire circumstances and turn them into something beautiful for God. And you cannot know the consequences. So only in your divine mind will you know the truth of what your own reality is. And this human mind simply cannot do it. It has too limited of a scope. In order to know this divine mind, you need to be able to meditate. You need to be able to go into the quietness of your own being. This constant chatter that the body and the mind produces is the disturbance that keeps us from knowing the divine mind. The divine mind is intimately connected with each and every one of us. It is not as if God has given one the doorway to their kingdom of heaven and to another not. We all have that doorway right within us. But what we must do is to calm this body, to calm the senses, to calm the mind, and to bring it into harmony with this divine mind. Now, as the reading told us tonight, this is no easy task. But if we begin our practice now and try to settle ourselves down, first of all, settle this body down, get it into a posture that it is easy for it to hold, whether that's seated cross-legged on the floor, whether that's seated with your feet on the floor, your hands in your lap, whatever the position, make it one where you can generally forget about the body. Then go deep within yourself. You will get sensations from the body. You will get the restlessness of the mind. It will all come up because this is all that reverberation that we have set up. The only way to stop that reverberation is to begin to maintain a quiet attitude. Now, what can help us in this practice is by singing to God, by thinking about God's virtues, by focusing our mind on these stories that we find uplifting. But ultimately, we bring the mind under control. And when we do so, what emerges is this beautiful spiritual mind of which we are all a part. You and me, every one of us. Only most of us remain in ignorance of it. So we go into the quietness. Imagine having access to being able to have entryway into an ancient temple in which the spiritual vibrations of God is so thick and so prevalent that you can't help but feel it. And then you are swept up in that environment, and your mind is exposed to the divine mind. This is exactly what you have right within you. You are the temple of the living God. And so it is true. You are the temple. You are the temple. We want to look everywhere outside of ourselves for that, but the fact is, you are that temple. And when you go inside and you close all the doors, that is, the entryway of the senses, the constant stimulation of the senses, and you go into the quietness of your own being, there you will feel the wonderful, powerful vibration of God. And you will feel swept up, and your mind will be merged into the divine mind. And you will begin to realize and understand these great truths. And the greatest truth is that you are made up of God stuff. You are the I am that I am, deep within you. My teacher mother had a wonderful experience. She went to Switzerland and met with a great sage, Elizabeth Hike. And in their meeting, Elizabeth Hike at first was critical of Yogananda. And then suddenly it was as if she recognized who Mother was in the greater sense. And she apologized and she says, I'm sorry, I didn't realize who you are. She said, why do you go around thinking you're the littlest one everywhere that you are? You are greater than Yogananda. You are greater than any saint that you have met or you ever will meet. Why don't you stand up straight and say, I am that I am? And so about 2 years later, Mother did that when she was in her own place. And she had that experience, and inwardly she felt directed to do this. And she stood up and said, I am that I am. And she said she had a terrific experience from that. So as this writing of Nelson Mandela says, why don't we claim our greatness in God? That is the thing that we are afraid of. And isn't there a truth to that? Don't we retire from the greatness of our own being? Now, this is not an egotistical way of looking at it. Rather, it is an acknowledgement of God within you. It is as if you are looking at a person that you've never met before and you don't have much interest in them. And then suddenly you come to know that perhaps they are a ruler of a great country. Well, your interest is piqued up a little bit. And then you find out they have great wealth. Well, maybe your desire nature gets going and your interest is piqued even more. And then you find out that they are a great philosopher and a great saint who has great powers in them. And suddenly you are absolutely glued to them. Would it surprise you for me to tell you that each and every one of you are that? You are kings and queens in your own right. You have spiritual power and glory that is beyond your comprehension, and yet we act as paupers. Now Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world, but you have a spiritual world in which you have tremendous wealth of peace, of bliss, of joy, of unending supply, of wisdom, complete wisdom. And it resides right within you. And yet we live in this life like we're little ants running around after this crumb of bread and that crumb of bread. And we get so excited when we find some stale old cake because it's got some sweetness to it. And yet we are like children in this way. We don't recognize what we have right within us. So let us no longer delay. Let us not put God last. Because you cannot have your life or your breath or your being were it not for that creative source. So why not put that first in your life? There is the principle in tithing, where it's said to tithe 10% of your income and give to the poor or spiritual, whatever you feel inwardly directed about. But I also ask you, 10% of your life. Out of a 24-hour day, that's about 2.5 hours. Can you devote that towards your spiritual pursuit? If you say you don't have time, I'll ask you how much television you watch in a day. How long it takes to watch a movie. And you don't have that much time to give to that source of your being who has given you everything. And that promises you such tremendous inward spiritual rewards for seeking. Why do we seek out after everything else but not God? Why is this? We have fallen into a state of delusion, and we run after shadows, thinking the shadows will bring us light. The only solution is to turn around, opposite of the shadows, and find out where the projectionist is shining that light. And then once seeing the light, merging ourselves, it's not enough just to see the light. It's not enough just to hear the Om, the sound, the Word of God, but to feel it, to experience it, to become one with it is the greatest thing. Mother once asked Yogananda, she says, so many talk about things that they see, spiritual visions, sounds that they hear. I don't see those things. I don't hear those things. I feel God within me. And Yogananda gave such a beautiful reply. He said, to see God is good. To hear God is better. To feel God is to be one with Him. So to enter into our own inner temple, to seal up it tight, to feel that vibration of God's gravity, and to know His oneness this very night. Feel yourself. Feel God within you. Know that that presence resides within you even as I speak these words. And that you can start yourself on such a spiritual journey that you will thank your lucky stars that this has become an opportunity for you to start your life new. Now these teachings, you cannot buy God, you cannot sell Him. These are not unique teachings to this time and place. They are the universal teachings that have been taught through all time. But when you find the truth, then stay with that. Move with that. Take it all the way to its source. When I first met Mother, I felt the power of the truth of what she was speaking. And I didn't understand it. I didn't understand all the words or the concepts that she used. But I knew that there is something unique about what she was giving to me, something that spoke to my soul, that fed me on some deep level, and that helped to transform my own consciousness and to make it more uplifted. And so I decided I didn't know what this was all about. I didn't know what the end was. But I wanted to find out. I wanted to get to the bottom of it. And that was over 23 years ago, and I'm still getting to the bottom of it. Because you see, with God, it's ever expanding. It's not like you, okay, I've done this God stuff, been there, done that. Moving on to the next thing. It's like you open into one room, and as you think that you've kind of explored that area, a whole new realm opens up before you, one that you hadn't even imagined. You know, there's that traditional conception of thinking about dying and going up to heaven and, you know, maybe being on a pink cloud and strumming harps all day. How boring. Who'd want that? That'd be good for maybe a day, maybe two, maybe a week. God is all intelligence, infinite intelligence. Can you imagine it? Can you imagine the study that goes in by our scientists into one small spectrum of this creation and then magnify that until you can't see the end of it? What a magnificent thing. How interesting. How fascinating. Can you think of the joy that you experience and then magnify that? Ever new joy, beyond your own vision, anything that you can envision. You see how limited, how dwarfed our vision has become of who and what we are? There is so much more. So my invitation is to come, take this exploration with me, with all of kindred spirits everywhere, who are searching out, and go for the highest truth, Don't settle for in-between states. Go for the highest realization, your absolute oneness with God. And realize in truth who and what you are. I'd like to read to you a prayer that I wrote the other day. Because sometimes we see ourselves as imperfect and therefore perhaps not worthy. But we all start out in a human sense in this way. And so this prayer is, O Lord, use my imperfections for your perfection. Take my weaknesses and turn them into your strength. Transform my indifference to your passion. Remember me always. Accept me as I am. Make use of the material I am, and transmit it to the glory of who you are. So whatever stuff that you are made up of, psychologically, physically, emotionally, ask God to use it, to take it, to help in this great transformation in which you come face to face with your own perfection. I'd like to stop there and see if there are any questions this evening on anything that I've spoken of or on your practice as you've been going. Well, Master used to say that doubt is natural, but that there's a difference between habitual doubt and honest doubt. Habitual doubt is no matter what I see, no matter what I experience, I will not believe it. It's an obstinacy. But when doubt comes to you, and doubt comes to all those, and especially until you've had the full experience, you have doubt. I was actually a very difficult disciple, I think, because, I not only wanted to see it, but I wanted to experience it. I wanted to know it in my bones. And I actually think this is a very good thing. I did not want to take anything because somebody else said it was true. It was only good to me if I could take it, put it in action in my life, and realize the truth of it. So I was skeptical even of when experiences started with me. And when I started to have revelations, and I would really put it on hold, and I said, I don't know the truth of this. I had an early experience one time of seeing this five-pointed star inside. And it was just a vision. There was no experience that went with it. It's wonderful to have. It was inspiring, really, at the time to see this. It lasted for about 5 minutes. And it was brilliant, and it was just clear as anything that I'd see outside of me. But it didn't move me. So it had a certain inspirational quality, but it didn't change my consciousness from the standpoint I didn't realize something new inside of me. It was repeated experiences that began to convince me in the very cells of my being that something real was going on here. And it wasn't until the truth began to emerge in me that eclipsed everything else that I'd known up until then that convinced me to the very core of my being of what it was that I was getting was true. And so this is the greatest search for truth, I think, is not to be convinced with intellectualisms. We can read books and be inspired, perhaps, open up new worlds to us mentally. But until we have the experience that shakes us to the very core of our being and convinces us on that level, then we should not be satisfied. Because this is the greatest thing, is that these truths are experienceable. They're not something that we have to take on faith. Now, in the beginning, we start out with a certain amount of faith. Perhaps we have an intuitive conviction about something. I remember the first time that I read a convincing discussion around reincarnation. And I thought, of course, that's the truth. There was a great intuitive knowing that, yes, that's of course, that's how things work. But to take it as deep, in other words, use your doubt. If there is a trace of doubt left in you, use that to go to God. God, say, God, erase this doubt. Convince me to the core of my being. Convince me beyond all doubt. And so that Thomas, the doubter, you know, he had to put his fingers in the wound. You know, that might have been me. You know, I need to touch it. I need to experience it. Even more than touch it, I need to know it so deeply in my being that it erases that doubt. And truth has that capacity.
What do you say to the Christ's statement, blessed are they that believe but do not see?
Well, I think that in the beginning of our path, we need to take on a certain amount of belief. Now, there is faith and there is belief. Belief is a mental state that you take a certain concept. I may believe in the theory of relativity, but I truthfully do not have the mathematical background or the experience of performing the experiments themselves to know that it's true. So that's something that I might believe, but I don't necessarily know through my own experience. So there is that belief through faith, but there is also that state that's beyond that, that is knowledge through experience. And that is a greater state to go to. So in the beginning, you start out with a belief, and you have faith in that because you feel called towards that. You feel that's the right way for you to go. But it's only until you feel anchored in the truth through your own experience that you really have it. And this is a great thing to remember, that our own doubt is not necessarily our enemy at all. It can be our friend. It can drive us further. And I don't think that we should be easily convinced. Neither should we be habitual doubters. So we should be open to the truth. But we should be very demanding in finding out exactly what that truth means to us and not espousing truths that are said by somebody else, but we ourselves have not truly realized. Everything that I say to you, I say from my own conviction based on my own experience, and I don't try to speak beyond my own experience. I might read from others, and that kind of thing, because it expresses something beautifully and perfectly. But this is a truth that I've experienced in my own being. And I think there's a great deal of difference between repeating something that you heard, that you have belief in, that you have faith in, and that you have actual experience in. So I'm one who thinks that doubt can be, you know, something that demands perfection. We should demand perfection from God because God is perfect. So unless it's perfect, I don't think that we should be satisfied with the answers until we get to a place where we ourselves realize it. When I was 12 years old, I came to intellectually understand what Orthodox Christianity taught around getting to heaven and that you had to be a Christian in order to get to heaven. And I said, well, what about all these millions of people in China, and now billions, and elsewhere in the world that had never even heard of Jesus? And, you know, well, they'll have some opportunity after they die to accept Jesus or not. And that's just something that they've never even heard of in their whole lives. And they get a chance to accept it or deny it then. So that doesn't even sound like a very good plan to me, much less a perfect plan. So, you know, I think it should test the test of reason. Now, getting revelations doesn't come through your reason. It comes through intuitive apprehension. But it should stand the test of reason. It should, everything that Mother ever taught had a reasonable basis to it. So it wasn't just pulling it out of thin air. It made sense. And so I think it should test the test of reason, even though we don't get it through the reasoning faculty of the brain. Yeah. So use your doubt. Wring the truth out of God, you know. Be like a good investigator and search out after it. And don't be satisfied until you have it. Possibly.
Mm-hmm. So what's I've been wondering about people who call themselves healers.
Mm-hmm.
Are they then doing the same thing?
Mm-hmm. They should pray to God and say, God, as you will for the highest good of all concerned. And really look for that inner direction around how they heal. But if they put that out first, that God, make this for the highest good of everybody concerned, then it can be done in perfection. If the ego gets involved and says, here's a stubborn illness, I'm going to overcome it, I'm going to heal it, power, even if it's the power of God within me, but I'm going to make this happen, then they operate out of error. Yeah. So that prayer should always proceed first. Lord, do what is good for the highest good of all concerned. And then you've cleared the way. And then be satisfied with the results. If nothing happens, that's all right.
So no attachment to the outcome.
Right. Yeah. Then you clear yourself of the CDs, of the powers, which can be a great trap. You know, when you're walking along on a sidewalk and if you feel as if you can float up into the air, you feel as if you can do miraculous things, and they're there. They're possible. But if you decide to move into the realm, that realm, you move into the level of cause and effect of that realm. You move into the karmic consequences of that realm. And then instead of ascending straight up the ladder to God, to total God consciousness, you get into those in-between planes, you're interrupting your own path. If you go all the way up and experience your oneness with God and then operate from that place, then you can operate all the powers and all the cities, but it comes effortlessly. It's not of your own will. It's of God within you, how it flows through you. And then there's no karmic consequence. So there's some paths that teach, you know, go to this level and then gain mastery of that, and then go to this level and gain mastery of that. Jesus said, seek ye first the kingdom of heaven, and then all these other things will be added to you. The kingdom of heaven is that highest spiritual consciousness, New Jerusalem. That's the crown chakra opened up fully. And then all these other things, all the powers, all the faculties, everything else will be given. And you have full command over them. You have full use of them. But yet it's not you any longer, but the divine consciousness within you. And that makes all the difference in the world. And that is our ultimate evolutionary state. So as I said, my favorite Murphy's Law is you can't just do one thing. So, it's a good thing to keep in mind. There are many yogis who rise up high in consciousness, but they get snagged by those powers.
What about the person seeking the healer?
Well, they should pray for guidance. If there's healing to be sought, say, Lord, take this away from me, if it be thy will. And then if you seek out someone to heal you, always keep God in front of you. And say, if it is according to your will, let this be done. Otherwise, I accept what I have. And there again, if you always keep that in the forefront of your mind, then it will happen perfectly. It's a difficult thing. This world is a tough place to live. When you experience or you see pain or suffering or difficulty, and you feel your identity with humanity, you feel the pain of that suffering. But you also realize that just like children growing up, if you're the parent of that child, you have to let your child get some bumps and bruises along the way. You don't want them to seriously hurt themselves, but they've got to take some chances and risks, and otherwise they're not worth so much, you know. you want somebody who has a bit of a spark to them, a bit of aliveness to them, maybe a little mischievousness to them. You want them to go out and explore. Unless they have that opportunity, they don't grow, and they don't get those experiences they can learn from. And we, in the same way, we need to go out and explore and find out what works for us and what doesn't. But when we find out that this world doesn't offer us the ultimate solution, so to speak, the real joy and happiness, then we go inward and we find it there. And it's even possible through great pain and suffering that we can even then focus our mind on God and find joy there. It's more difficult, no doubt. And so we should keep this body in good health. It's beneficial to us. But even if we are in suffering, we can offer that suffering up. It's said in the Bhagavad Gita that pain and bliss are the same to the yogi, even as it says that fame and blame are the same. Now, those are difficult sayings. But God showed me once how on a nervous system level, that pleasure and pain both use the same nervous system, and they're both the same electrical impulses and the life force that comes up through the nervous system and gets registered in our brain. And in that sense, pleasure and pain are the same thing. They have these impulses that come up and register in the brain. So what we can do is we can work on letting that pain go. 80% of pain, they estimate, is the anticipation or the fear that's created through pain. The people who have chronic pain, the much bigger problem is that they are constantly anticipating, thinking about having this pain forever, or they're afraid of when the next painful impulse is going to come. If we could eliminate that fear and that attachment in that way, it would reduce that pain by a great degree. So it's possible, Mahatma Gandhi had this appendicitis operation without any anesthetics at all. He is able to switch off the pain impulses that came up to his brain, and he's fully conscious, and he chatted with his students and devotees who were around him, and while he was cut open and they were doing this operation on him. So it's remarkable how much we're conditioned around this body. They discovered a young boy in the foothills of Germany. This was many years ago, but he had never been socialized. Somehow he had lived out in the woods all on his own. And didn't wear clothes, didn't have speech, nothing. And so they brought him in. They tried to socialize him over time and had some success. It would be snowing outside, extremely bitterly cold. One of his great joys was to run outside naked and play in the snow. Now, for anybody of us, we'd be shivering and shaking. We'd be running for the next shelter. We'd want all the clothes we could get. Here this boy was, he had no consciousness of it. We hear these stories of these yogis in Tibet and in the Himalayas who can sit out and actually melt snow around them. So the capacity that we have for this body, for this energy, for this life force that we have, we tap barely even a small percentage of it. So our conditioning has gone a great deal towards our own sensitivity, towards what we can do and what we can't do. So part of it is to get rid of that conditioning and begin, instead of attaching ourselves to this body, we attach ourselves to the higher mind. And by doing that, we open ourselves to the capacities that we have that are innate, inborn, and that we don't have to suffer in the way that we do. It's an interesting story of Edgar Cayce, who was known as the sleeping prophet and could put himself into these trance states and speak through his other self, a higher self within him. And that ability came about because he had, in a previous lifetime, been on a battlefield. And in that battlefield, he'd been very badly injured and was in a great deal of pain and was left there for 3 days. No food, no water, in a great deal of pain. He learned to disassociate from his body and to go into a different state of consciousness. And through that ability, in this current lifetime as Edgar Cayce, he had that ability to lie down and disassociate and allow this other state of consciousness to operate through him. And so we can take any experience that comes to us and work to make it work for us, for our own highest good. Now, it's a difficult thing, but when people are in suffering, unless the soul has decided to leave this body, we prematurely cut short the benefit that we could derive from that if we commit suicide or if somebody assists us in committing suicide during that time. Now, nobody likes to see suffering, and certainly nobody likes to experience it. But unless we begin to recognize what the soul's purpose for in coming into this body, we are premature. And what that means is we will have to come back to that time again until we are able to move through that experience fully. So sometimes we get that experience plus interest. So it's kind of a pay now or pay later kind of plan.
Tries to feed starving children. I mean, you can't say to that person, you may be interfering with these.
Oh, no, of course not. That's an act of compassion. And any time that something comes from the heart and you feel God inspires you to do that, then do that with the fullness. It does not mean not to relieve suffering. That's not it at all. The thing is to pay attention to your own inner direction. You could go to Somalia with whatever funds you have and you could distribute it in a moment. And all the money is gone. That may or may not be what God would like you to do with that money. So any individual could go there and do that. We could spend our lives there serving those souls there, trying to help feed them, even as Mother Teresa did in Calcutta, one small woman who went to this foreign country and put herself in with the poorest of the poor. And look at what it's resulted. Wonderful, wonderful works. She serves the Christ in everybody that she meets. So it's not saying to not do that, not to do acts of compassion. Of course not. But allow your compassion to flow from your own divine consciousness, from your own highest conception. And don't always assume that just because you think it's the right thing to do, ask God. Go in and pray deeply first. Ask God. And then it'll flow out perfectly. Well, follow your heart. You know, if I were seeing a child being abused or something, I probably wouldn't wait for God's answer. I would just rush in and do something to stop that. you know. But the thing is to let God lead you. Mother once asked me a question. She used to do question and answers, start out groups sometimes. So she asked the question, if you saw a man who is going to kill 100 individuals with a bomb, and the only way to stop him was to shoot that person, would you do it? And so nobody volunteers an answer, including me. So she looks at me and she says, David. So I'm on the spot. Well, in my own clever mind, I think, well, what am I going to say here? And I said, well, I would ask God. She says, not enough time. You got to make the decision right now. I said, well, I would shoot him and take whatever karmic consequences came as a result, if it could save those people. And she said, in that case, there would be no karmic consequence for doing such an action. So it's an interesting thing. But the main thing isn't to say not to do acts of compassion. Of course, that's what we're doing. That's, you know, in this plane of duality, we have the unique privilege of serving each other. In the realm of total oneness of God, there is nothing but God. So the, you know, but here in the plane of relativity, we have the capacity for God to serve God. I can serve you, you can serve me. Yeah, that's a wonderful thing. And when you see a world that has such need, even as our world does, then to reach out of compassion and to be able to give, be able to love, be able to serve. And that can be in your everyday job, whatever it is that you do. You can do the very best job as an act of service towards God. And you can divinize that. God once showed me not too long ago how this world has evolved, and that all the ills of this world can be pinned on individuals not living up to their fullest light. Now, this is not even to say having full God realization. It's living up to the fullest light of which they're capable of living in that moment. So whether that's not abusing a child, even as Hitler's father abused him, or whether that's for an individual to give something to another, and instead out of greed or stinginess, they don't do that. Whatever it is, those impulses, in whatever ways that we don't live up to that highest light, that's why this world finds itself in a place where there are plagues, in a place where there is a lack of food, in a place where there is a lack of love, lack of community, because individuals do not live up to the highest light within themselves. And so if each one of us just did that, that this world could be transformed into a literal Garden of Eden. We would have enough to eat. We would have enough to provide for everybody. There would be love in abundance. There would be caringness. There would be nurturing relationships. We would have it all. And that is not any great thing to ask of people, to live up to the highest of which they are capable.
What do you do about the act of compassion that immediately causes your ego to just hit the roof?
To soar, huh? Yeah. What a need a little longer arm to pat yourself on the back with? Well, I'll tell you, when somebody gives me a compliment or when they pay respects to me in some way or whatever, I inwardly bow to God or Guru within me, and I just give it to them. I know that's the source of my life, the source of my intelligence, the source of everything that I have. And so it's a pass-through. It comes through me, and it goes right on past. And in that way, I surrender it all into the one life. And sometimes if I get to thinking that, you know, I'm a little better, you know, then God has a habit of taking me down a peg. So it kind of cures itself. So the more egotistical we are, the harder and greater our fall will be. And so go ahead and build it right on up, you know. But don't blame anybody when you go for a big fall. And if you get a bloody nose and skinned up knees, then learn your lesson and pick yourself up and keep going. But one thing about being on the spiritual path, you tend to get a faster turnaround time. So when you do things, the results come back to you much quicker. And so you get a pretty direct cause and effect there. And so if you get off the path, if you get off, you'll feel it inwardly. You won't feel right. At first, you may have an elevated feeling when the ego gets a hold of something. It can make you feel quite great for a while. But it won't take too long before you'll start noticing you're off track somehow. You're not feeling that oneness with God. You're getting anxious about things, about repeating the performance again. Will people think you're just as wonderful as they thought you were last time? Will you think you're just as wonderful? And remember, whatever you judge your world by, you judge yourself by. So if you have people that you know who are very critical of you and everybody else around you, those are the same scales of balance of justice that they judge themselves by. And that's why Jesus said, unless you forgive, you will not be forgiven. He wasn't saying God won't forgive you. He's saying you won't forgive yourself. And if you hold on to resentment or anger or bitterness, who has it? You do. So whatever you hold on to, that's your possession. Do you want it? You have to ask yourself that. So let it go. Let it go. What do you need it for? And you have wonderful questions.
Stop stuttering a lot.
God within you has wonderful questions.